Okay. Just want to wish everybody a Freilich and Chanukah. Tonight's the first night of Chanukah, and it's Parshas Miketz, Tavshin Ayin Ches. So let's begin from the beginning, page 222. Two thoughts on the Parsha we'll have, and then we'll touch on a Chanukah thought. Vayhi Miketz Shenasayim Yamim, and it was at the end of 2 years, Ufare Chaylei Paro dreamt, V'nei Eimer Alei Ar, and behold, he was standing by the Nile. So the Medrash points out, and as Rashi points out, as the Medrash points out, that the 2 years we're referring to here was the extra 2 years that was added to Yosef's sentence from Shemayim. Yosef had to languish in jail for another 2 years because of the fact that at the end of last week's Parsha, when he was interpreting the dream of the Sar Mashkim, the Sar Oithim, of the wine butler and of the main baker for Paro, that after he interpreted the dream of the wine butler that he will return to his position, so he asked him to remember him. Yosef asked the wine butler to remember him when he returns to his position in Paro and to basically help him out because he was wrongfully jailed. And because of the fact that Yosef, the Medrash says, because Yosef enlisted his help, because of that, he had to stay in jail for another 2 years. There is a Medrash at the end of last week's Parsha that reads, on the Pasuk, that the last Pasuk in last week's Parsha that reads, the wine butler did not remember Yosef and he forgot him. V'amru chazal, our sages say on this, Ashrei ha-geresh ha-sam Hashem miftachai. We have a pasuk, we have a verse. Fortunate is the person who puts his trust in Hashem. Who is that person who put his trust in Hashem? Ze Yosef. This is referring to Yosef. V'lai pane al-rahav v'asate chazav. And he did not turn to vanities and to people who do corrupt things. Al yedei she'amar l'sar ha-mashkim, because Yosef spoke to the sar ha-mashkim, huskat liyos asur shtei shonim, he had to remain 2 more years in jail. Now, this medrash seems to be contradictory. First it says, who is the person who puts his trust in Hashem? Yosef. And then it says, and fortunate is the man who didn't turn to vain sources, because Yosef did turn to the Sar HaMashkim for help, he was punished in 2 more years in jail. Well, which one is he? Is he the person who displays his trust in Hashem, or is he the person that is showing his lack of trust in Hashem, which because of that he had to languish in jail 2 more years? So the way that the commentaries explain this is, or one way of explaining this is that only because Yosef essentially really was a person who put his trust in Hashem, because Yosef reached a level that he could put his trust in Hashem, when he went ahead and he turned to help from the wine butler, for him that was considered a sin. And only because he really was a person who put his trust in Hashem, only because he was a person who was at that level and had before put his trust in Hashem, and he was at that level of putting his trust in Hashem, therefore now when he enlisted the Sar HaMashkim for help, that was considered something wrong. At the same time, though, we still have to understand, what did he do wrong? So one way of approaching this is again, Yosef is at a certain level of trust in Hashem, and for him to enlist he's at a high level of trust in Hashem, and for him to enlist help from the wine butler was below what he should have done. So then, how do we understand, what was Yosef thinking? What was Yosef thinking? Yosef was oblivious, Yosef didn't understand, he was really at the level, he could put his full trust in Hashem, and he mistook his level, And therefore, he did put some kind of ishtaz, did put some kind of effort in getting himself free. Is that how we have to understand it? That Yosef is really at the level that he shouldn't ask help. He should have put his trust in Hashem. He didn't understand that, and therefore he asked the wine butler, but he should have understood that, and therefore he was punished. Is that how we're going to put this all together? So, the Shari Oira from Rav Meir Tzvi Bergman brings an explanation from his father-in-law, Rav Shach Zatzal. And it gives a very interesting insight into what Yosef was thinking when he enlisted the help of the Sar HaMashkim. And he starts off with a Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara in Chulin takes each part of the dream of the wine butler and gives it a much deeper interpretation. We know the dream was, he had a dream, there were three clusters of grapes, the grapes were budding and turning into grapes, meaning they had like three vines or seed, three tendrils, I think they're called. And the grapes were growing, and then he squeezed the grapes and he gave the grapes to Paro. So basically, you know, Yosef interpreted the dream in its pretty basic interpretation. It's a sign that he's going back. But the Gemara takes each part of the dream and says it represents something much greater. Gefen, the vine, Elu Yisrael. That's referring to the Jewish people. Shlosha Sarigim, the three clusters or the three tendrils. Elu Gemara Regalim. That refers to the Shalosh Regalim. Three times the Jewish people appear at the Beis HaMikdash on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Ol Sanitza began producing the fruit. Higiyaz Varam Shal Yisrael LeGoyal, that represents that the time for the Jewish people to redeem has come. So basically, in the Sarah Mashkim's dream was the future of the Jewish people. So when Yosef heard the dream of the Sarah Mashkim, it's not just that he heard the dream as a message for the Sarah Mashkim getting back to his position, but the future of the Jewish people that lies in this dream, the vine representing and the grapes representing and the growth of the grapes representing, all about the future of the Jewish people. Basically, everything about the Jewish people for their future of eventually leaving Mitzrayim, coming to Eretz Yisrael, and being the Jewish people. Yosef knows that in this dream lies illusions of the future of the Jewish people, which means that this Sarah Mashkim, this wine butler, is going to have some kind of part in bringing about the future of the Jewish people. And if he is being shown this, then that's a message that what? That he should be basically making this happen. He should be part of this. If Hashem is showing him this, if he hears the dream and he knows what it's alluding to, that it's alluding to the future of the Jewish people, if this is what's being revealed to Yosef, then why is it being revealed to him? The answer is because he's got to make it happen. Through this Sarah Mashkim, through this wine butler, he's got to make happen the future of the Jewish people. And therefore, you know why he says to the wine butler, when you go before the Paro, remember me? Yosef is doing it not because he's trying to enlist help to get out. He knows Rabbi Nishlam can help him for that. But what he's doing is he's trying to help along this prophecy. He's trying to help along what he's been shown. He's been shown that this wine butler has a part in creating the future of the Jewish people. And if he's being shown that, that means he has to be part of it. And he understands. How is he part of it? By having the Sarah Mashkim getting him out.
Then he did nothing wrong.
Then seemingly he did nothing wrong. So Rav Shach said, what we'd have to say is that clearly this was Yosef's intention. However, you have to be able to remain completely l'shem shamayim, completely for the sake of heaven. For Yosef to have done this without any kind of fault, that means that when he asks the Sarah Mashkim to help him to get him out, he's got to be doing it completely 100,000,000% with the intention of doing it to promote the future of the Jewish people. There can't be anything about him in it. And what the Medrash is telling us is that when Yosef did ask the Sarah Mashkim for help, to some level, there was a personal motive mixed in. At some level, there was a personal request mixed in. In Yosef's mind, he is trying to bring about the future of the Jewish people. But there was a certain level of asking for himself. And that was where he went wrong. When he was asking the Sarah Mashkim to help him, he had to keep that completely clean, completely pure, completely free of anything personal. And he was not able to, and he did not do that. And therefore, he is held at fault for the fact that even though his request in itself should have been okay because he understood this is how he has to create the future of the Jewish people, but when doing that, that had to be his sole intention. And the Medrash is telling us that what got mixed in as he was asking was for his personal benefit also.
Why 2 years? Written?
That I don't know. I don't have an answer to that right now. But that is how he explains where Yosef went wrong. Yosef was not completely oblivious of the idea of putting his trust in Hashem. But the challenge that Yosef faced here was that he should be able to be asking to be taken out of jail without any kind of personal gain, any kind of thought of personal gain. only about promoting and bringing about the future of the Jewish people that was alluded to him in the dream of the wine butler. And the Medrash is telling us that he wasn't able to completely separate that. He wasn't able to completely take himself out of that request. You're going to say it's a challenge. It's a challenge to be able to ask the Sar Avashkim, remember me, get me out of here, and be doing that completely not for himself, but to bring about the future of the Jewish people that was revealed to him. That was where he went wrong, and that's where he was held responsible.
I'm trying to understand the notion of putting one's trust, Hashem. But if you keep going, you could say, well, then you do nothing and Hashem will.
Well, so without getting too much into this right now, the Mefarshim explained by Yosef that one way of explaining it is that there are some people who reach a level that they should just put their trust in Hashem and not do anything more. There are people who reach that level. There are people who are sincere enough and strong enough in their trust in Hashem that they reach a level where they should only be putting their trust in Hashem. That's one approach. Another approach is that Yosef, looking at everything that happened to him until now, should have clearly seen Hashem's hand in his survival. And therefore, for Yosef specifically, who has already seen Hashem's hand, his miraculous hand of Hashem in his survival, he should have just, so to speak, allowed that to keep going. Because when Hashem is already showing him that he's taking care of everything, then let that continue. That would be a way of approaching specifically the question of, you know, hishtadlus, we have to put efforts, and not just rely on Hashem, we have to put some kind of effort. What did Yosef do wrong? So the point is going to be that Yosef at some point should have realized that Yosef is at a point that he should be putting his trust in Hashem. Now the question is, okay, so when Yosef did it, was it because he missed the boat, he missed the point? Or can we say there's something deeper to it? This explanation is there was a much greater calculation in Yosef's asking the Sar HaMashkim for help than just asking for help. However, the point that the Medrash would be saying is that he wasn't able to completely keep his request complete clean of any kind of personal request. Okay. Now we know that after Yosef interprets the dream of Paro, he's elevated to viceroy. And then the Torah tells us there's a famine in the land of Canaan. Yaakov sends his sons down to buy food. They appear before Yosef. And the Pasuk says, take a look at page 232. Pasuk Perek Membeis, Pasuk Ches. Bottom line, Vayaker Yosef as Echav. Yosef recognized his brothers. Vehem lo hi kiruhu, but they did not recognize him. So Rashi tells us, why didn't they recognize him? Lefi shehinicham chasumei zaken. When he left his brothers, they all were old enough to have beards. Vehem lo hi kiruhu. Sheyatza meyetzlam eloi chasim ezaken. When he left at his young age, he didn't have a beard. And now they found him with a beard, so they didn't recognize him, right? So you mean on Purim, when you put on a fake beard, oh, it's not you? No one's going to recognize you, right? I was just by my daughter's wedding, somebody came in, an old friend of mine came in. I mean, he's younger than me. He was someone who had come to daven in our shul for many years, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and he walked up to me, and I looked, and it did take me a second or two before I realized who it was. But after 2-3 seconds, you realize who it is. It was funny. He went over to my daughter. She recognized him right away. Okay? But, so it's really odd that, you know, because Yosef's got a beard, they don't recognize him anymore. I mean, they do a lot of, they're going to spend a lot of time with him. They're going to be a lot of talking with him. Very strange that they can't finally realize that something's going on. You know, is it a secret that some slave turned into a viceroy? Is Yosef's whole story completely a secret? The Shari Oira again brings a story with the Panav Hazharav. The Panav Hazharav, just to bring out the idea of how easy it is to recognize people. that the Panavisha Rav was one time walking behind someone, and just from his movements, his body movements, he said to himself, this is so-and-so's son. There's no question. This is there was a man in Panavish. This was already in Eretz Yisrael years later. He says, this man must be the son of so-and-so from Panavish. Taps him on the shoulder, asks him, are you so-and-so's son? He says, yep, 100%. You got it. You know, we know that there are so many ways of recognizing a person. How do we understand that the brothers couldn't recognize Yosef because now he had a beard? So the Shari Arya brings on an answer from Rabbi Cheska Levenstein, who was the Mashkiach in Panavish, and also the Mashkiach in the Mir Yeshiva in Europe beforehand. And basically, Rabbi Chatzko Levenstein's answer is that, or the answer that we would all have to say is that, yeah, they should have recognized them, but the Ribbono Shel Olam made it that they shouldn't. In order to make sure everything's going to happen, it must have been that Hashem made it that they don't recognize him. Now, it's at this point that Reb Chatzko gave an insight that is very unique to the Bali Musar, who took what seems to be like little nuances, but brought out a very strong idea from it. So we ask a question: why the brothers couldn't recognize Yosef? And what do we answer? Hashem took away their ability to recognize. That's how we would say it, right? Hashem made it; they shouldn't recognize him. They should have recognized him, and Hashem made it; they couldn't. He took away their ability to recognize. So Reb Chatzko said, that's not the way to say it. He says, imagine a person, again, before calculators, and he's got a bunch of big numbers, and he's got to calculate all the numbers together, and a correct calculation, a miscalculation can make a big difference in money. Okay? So he's got, you know, these big numbers in front of him, he's got to calculate, and as he's calculating, there's a thought that will probably go through his. There's a prayer that'll go through his head, where he'll say, "Ribbono Shel Olam, help me get this right." He recognizes he's possibly lacking the ability, and so therefore he davens to Hashem. He requests from Hashem, "Help me get this right." Okay, that's when he's got the sheet of paper with lots of big numbers. You put a piece of paper in front of him. It says 2 + 2. Tell him to calculate it. Right, so. Is he going to say, Ribbono Shel Olam, help me figure this out? No. 2 + 2 = 4 is very simple. And that's it. No big deal. Truthfully, though, the same ability to calculate 2 + 2, or the same way that a person needs Hashem to help him calculate those big numbers, he needs the same help to calculate 2 + 2. Because we're not born, we don't inherently, intrinsically have this ability. But rather, whatever we do, and whatever we can do, is given to us. That ability to do what we do is given to us by Hashem. You want to calculate 2 + 2, you are your ability to calculate 2 + 2 is because now Hashem gives you that ability. Hashem now gives you what we call siyata d'shamayah, divine assistance. He gives you the ability to make that calculation. If he doesn't give you that ability to make that calculation, then you're not going to calculate it. But it's not pshat. It's not, you shouldn't look at it as, I have the ability, and maybe Hashem will take it away from me. No, that's not the way you look at it. The way you have to look at it is that every time I can do something, I can do it because now Hashem has given me the ability to do it. So when we have to explain why the brothers couldn't recognize Yosef, don't say Hashem took away their ability to recognize Yosef. But rather, Hashem didn't give them the ability now. He didn't give them the ability. Not that he took away the ability, he didn't give them the ability. Because anything that we do, we only can do because Hashem is giving us that ability to do it. He's now giving us the ability. And if you don't recognize him, it's because now Hashem is not giving them that ability. So the nuance is, don't look at things as, we've got something that's a question of Hashem taking it away. But rather, whatever it is that we have and we're doing, it's because Hashem is now giving us the ability to do it. And if we stop having the ability, it's not it's not, in essence, he took it away from us, but he stopped giving it to us. And that's what he wanted to bring out, Reb Chatzkel, in this idea. Wanted to bring it out here. Apparently here, this is where he brought it out here, because it's just a perfect example of saying, well, why didn't they recognize him? Of course they should recognize him. Hashem took it away. No, it's not Hashem took it away. The nuance is that any time, any ability to recognize is because that point of time Hashem is giving the ability to recognize. And there, and at this point Hashem didn't give them the ability to recognize. Sure, we expect that, because looking at the natural, at our natural existence, this is what's expected. But in essence, that's not the truth. The truth is that anything that we're able to do is because presently Hashem is giving us the ability to do that. And if he doesn't give us the ability, then we can't do it. So it was a nuance in this was, I guess, an opportunity to bring out that nuance. That don't look at it that Hashem took away their ability to recognize him, but rather you have to say Hashem didn't give them the ability. Because anytime you have the ability to recognize, because Hashem then gives you the ability to do so. And if you're not going to have the ability to do so, it means Hashem didn't give you the ability to do it. And therefore, the brothers cannot recognize him. Now, I had a little question on this idea. Well, if that is what we have to say, that Hashem took away, Hashem didn't give them the ability to recognize, so why do you need a beard? Right? Rashi says the reason why they didn't recognize him is because now he had a beard. If the beard doesn't really work, and we have to say that Hashem stopped giving them the ability to recognize, then what do you need the beard for? It? So I think the answer to that is going to be that, you know, without a beard, it's like a miracle. It's a miracle. Without a beard, it's a miracle. With a beard, already it becomes somewhat, you know, a certain level of well, you know, when a person has a beard, they don't always recognize him and things like that. So even though it doesn't completely make sense that they shouldn't have come to recognize him, but Hashem is not going to basically do almost an open miracle that they shouldn't recognize him even without a beard. That's the only answer that I would have to that. Okay, Hanukkah thought. There's a famous question that is asked. Oh, no, let's say this one. Sorry. The halacha is that you cannot fulfill your mitzvah of lighting the Hanukkah candles unless you do it in your house, or it's something considered your house. So, for instance, if you go away for Hanukkah and you stay somewhere...
If you don't know in a hotel?
No, you would, right? If you go to a hotel... Right. So being that you're staying overnight in the hotel now becomes your home. But basically, you need a bias. You need a house. You need something to be considered your house. You don't have to own it, right? But you have to be lighting in a house, and the house has to be considered your house. To be considered your house is very flexible when it comes to the laws of Hanukkah.
But when Jews...
One second. Okay. Now. But without a house, you can't fulfill your mitzvah. Now, even the people who light outside, they're not going to tell you, right, that you fulfill your mitzvah with it. Your personal mitzvah, you got to do in your house.
Oh, I see.
They feel there's also persuminisa. There's a mitzvah persuminisa. You can do it outside and make a bracha, whatever it may be. But none of them are going to say that they don't have to light at home. Because to fulfill the actual obligation, Chazal, when they instituted the mitzvah of Neres Chanukah, they connected it to a bias, to a house. Now, Hanukkah and Purim are the two holidays that are not from the Torah. And there's one very famous difference between Hanukkah and Purim, in the sense that although on Hanukkah we make Hanukkah parties, there's no obligation to have a meal in honor of Hanukkah. While we know on Purim, one of the four mitzvahs you do on Purim is the Suda. You have to wash, basar, yayin, you have to have a meal. Why on Purim do we have an obligation for a meal and Hanukkah not? So the commentary of the Bach explains that Purim, we were in physical danger. Haman wanted to physically annihilate us. So when Hashem saved us, we celebrate in the manner by which we were in danger. Hanukkah, our danger was not physical. If we were to adopt the Hellenistic culture, we're fine, which many of them did. It was a religious persecution. If you didn't give in, your life was in danger.
But also he wanted to kill everyone.
No, he didn't. He wanted everyone to turn into a Yavani. If everyone would have just dropped all their Yiddishkeit and become Hellenists, he would have been fine.
No, but Haman.
Haman wanted to kill everybody out. So Haman was a physical danger.
Right.
Therefore, we have a mitzvah of a suda. We have a mitzvah of having a feast, a physical feast, because we celebrate in the manner by which we were saved. Hanukkah, which was really a religious danger, was a danger to our spirituality. So then the sages did not institute to celebrate that with a physical meal, but lehidus lahalo, to praise Hashem for that salvation. There's a similarity to Purim and Hanukkah in the sense that one of the key elements of the Hanukkah candles we know is Persume Nisa, publicizing the miracle. On Purim, we also have a mitzvah, Persume Nisa. When we read the Megillah, we read it in public. We're supposed to read it in public because that publicizes the miracle. But it's interesting that the publicizing of the miracle on Purim is to read the Megillah in public, while Hanukkah candles are not to be done in public. One second. They're meant to be done in a home, facing outside, right? But on Purim, that's not what we do, right? We don't all read the Megillah, at home and open our windows so that everybody should hear it. Basically, it's the Persume Nisa, the whole publicizing of the miracle of Purim is done in public. While the publicizing of the miracle of Hanukkah is meant to be done in the house to the public. And really, and sometimes you can't even do it to the public. You're only doing it privately. But the Persume Nisa, the publicizing of the miracle, is not done publicly. It's done really privately in a way that the public sees it. Why is the miracle of Hanukkah, the publicized miracle of Hanukkah, why is it focused? Why does it have to be in a bais? Why does it have to be in a house? So there's an explanation that's given based on the writing of the Rambam. The Rambam wrote a letter called Igeres Teman, a letter to Yemen. Yemenite Jews in the Rambam's time were suffering terribly, religious persecution, terribly. And he wrote them a letter to encourage them, to strengthen them. And in part of that letter, he conveys to them that, basically, you're going through what Jews have gone through throughout their history. Religious persecution has been part of Jewish history. And when he mentions Hanukkah, he mentions that one of the decrees that the Greeks had was to remove all doors from the home. You were not allowed to have a door, or at least a door closed. Okay, every door, they removed the doors. Every house had to be open. Now, why is that? Now, you may say, because they always wanted to have access to the house. I don't know, that bothers me a little bit because we know, unfortunately, that breaking down doors by soldiers, done all the time. So really, you have to take off the doors and always keep them open for easy access, perhaps. But clearly, what was also going on was by having your house open to the public, it means you had no privacy. It means you were not able to create the secure enclave that a home is meant to be. A home is meant to be a refuge from the public. It's meant to be a refuge from what's going on outside. We have to live in the world, we go out to the world, and a home is meant to be the place where we bring our families within its secure walls and secure them spiritually, secure them emotionally. They don't have to be exposed to everything out there in the street all the time. We need to give them that security and that privacy and that seclusion and invest in them and put in our homes a spirit of purity and holiness that our children, our families imbue that so when they go out into the street, they're not as affected. But by the Greeks basically keeping the doors open, they basically took away the ability for the Jewish people to not be exposed to what's going on in the street. And that could have been, and if that wasn't indirectly their intention, it could have been directly their intention, it could have been indirectly. But at the same time, without any doors, everybody sees what's going on in the streets, all the children see what's going on in the streets. And there was plenty going on in the streets because the streets were Hellenizing. This is what the Greeks wanted. They didn't want the Jewish people to be able to create that spiritual oasis, what a Jewish home is supposed to be. And therefore, when we celebrate the salvation of the miracle of Purim, we celebrate it in the home. Because the Jewish home was under attack by the Greeks. And we now report the Jewish home is for the continuity of the Jewish people. And the fact that the Greeks wanted to expose Jewish homes to everything out there was about destroying the spirit of Judaism that we have, destroying what the homes do for us. Therefore, when we celebrate Hanukkah, we celebrate it in the home. You got to light the menorah in the home. You got to commemorate the salvation in the home. Yes, we want to be a light to the outside. We want to be a light to the nations. We want people to be able to recognize the miracle. But it's got to be happening. But it has to be happening in the home. It has to be happening in the home. Then it can go out to the public. But it has to be happening in the home to stress and to thank Hashem for giving us back the spirituality and the holiness of the home that the Greeks were trying to violate. Now, related to this, I'd like to share with you something that I spoke about in Shul this past week. And as we know, the struggle of Hanukkah was a religious struggle. It was a struggle between the Greek culture and Greek religion against the Torah. They were trying to, as we say, in Alanisim, Lashkicham Torasecha, to make them forget the Torah. That is what the Greeks wanted. And the Greeks, and what the Greeks stressed, we know, was physical beauty and physical strength, which is a very enticing thing. And that was part of how they enticed the Jewish people to Hellenize and to become like the Greeks. And in last week's parsha, we have the episode of Yosef being seduced by his master's wife and his resisting, and how the Mefarshim point out that the Jewish people's ability to remain pure in Egypt, which was a very immoral society, but the fact that their families were able to remain pure, the fact that the only one woman was violated when the Jewish people were in Egypt, and that their yichas, their lineage, remained pure, there is a comment that the lineage of the Jewish people remained pure because of Yosef. Because Yosef stayed pure in Egypt, he then imbued the Jewish people with that holiness and that spirit of purity that allowed them to remain pure even when they were enslaved to the Egyptians, when it only made sense that they should be terribly violated. But they weren't violated. They were able to keep their holiness due to Yosef's righteousness, due to Yosef retaining his moral purity and holiness. So I've always felt that the contemporary Ashes Potiphar. Nowadays, there is a wife of Potiphar that's after all of us. And the contemporary Ashes Potiphar that's after all of us is the values of society. The morals of society. What society considers morally correct and what's not morally correct. And there are things that in society are considered basically clean entertainment. Clean entertainment. There are certain modes of behavior and modes of undress that in society is not a problem. That's passé. It's passé. These are kinds of behaviors that are in secular society innocent, which for us, gazing at them would be halachically prohibited. And it's all over. We have it on the internet, we have it in advertising, we have it in our entertainment. And I'm talking about from the days that I was watching television. That's a long time ago. From the days that I was watching television, I can tell you, right, that there were so many things that were just passé that for us are forbidden to gaze at. Forget about engaging at, forbidden to gaze at. And I'm talking about what you could see on Bugs Bunny, on the cartoons. There were enough things on those that did that again. You know, originally the cartoons were made for adults, fine. But the point is that they're showing them to kids all the time, and it was no big deal. It was no big deal. And for us, this is impurity. And to me, this is such a great, I just always have to consider this such a great danger. You know, there's terrible things out there. There's no question. Because of the internet, we have access to so many terrible things. But one of the biggest problems is not only the terrible things. It's the thing, there are things out there that even society considers them, you know, edgy. But there are certain things society doesn't consider a problem at all. And for us us Torah Jews, halachically immoral, halachically forbidden. And we face that big challenge that society says, it's fine, it's okay. And we have to be able to reject that and understand it's not okay. These things are not okay. And that is one of the biggest challenges that we have. And our legacy as Jews and as Torah Jews is a legacy of purity and of holiness. And that was what's under attack on Hanukkah, and that is what the Hashmonaim fought for. They fought for the Torah, they fought for the purity of the Jewish people, and they fought for the holiness of the Jewish people. And it's a time for us on Hanukkah to think about that. And in a practical example, I believe these kinds of things that we face in society that are just passe and no big deal to people out there and are considered clean entertainment or no big deal, you have to realize for us, it's a big deal. It's a problem. These are things that for us are forbidden. These are things that compromise our legacy of holiness and of purity. I wish you all a happy Hanukkah. And I don't want to make any of you watching this or listening to jealous, but we're going to break now for our Hanukkah party. I wish you all a happy Hanukkah.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Walking in the mall and walking around.